Okay. So we started two times ago, and when we spoke about mysticism and prophecy, one of the things that I tried to show was what exactly the mystics did. And for that part, to put it into one sentence, what they did was they tried to re-experience the prophetic experience. So how they did that, so that I wasted an hour of your lives trying to explain that. But essentially, the mystics tried to re-experience prophecy. During the time of prophecy, there was also this desire, a much more profound desire for idolatry. So that was one of the things that we saw as well, that when they prayed to remove the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination for idolatry, the unexpected collateral damage was they also lost the ability of prophecy. That means prophecy ends when the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah ends. The two of those things are somehow interconnected, interrelated. That's what we saw, a teaching based upon something which was said by the Vilna Gaon in his commentary to a book which is called the Seder Olam Rabbah. Fine. Therefore, what I asked you to consider was that when the mystics re-experience a prophetic type of experience, and therefore they get to this type of enlightenment, will this also in some way, shape, or form bring back the evil inclination, as it were? Because one of the things in life is that there always needs to be in life some type of a balance between what we can call trying to do good and bad. I'm not saying it's always absolutely even, but there needs to be some kind of a balance. And therefore, if these people were able now to re-experience prophetic type of experience of enchantment, of enlightenment, so it makes sense that there would be something which would be pulling the other way around. Good. Full stop. And that led us to what we did last time. Last time we started about Elisha ben Avuya, who's also known as Acher. We learned the passage that said four people went into paradise, four people entered into paradise, four people entered the Garden of Eden. One of them, Rabbi Akiva, everything works out okay. He's okay going in, he's okay going out. One of them died, that was Ben Azai, and the way we understood it is, of course, it was too enchanting, and he didn't want to come back. It was just seeing something which was too wonderful. And one was Ben Zoma, who comes back, but he is totally obsessed with the experience that he had, and it was very hard for him to live a normal life. The one which is, for some people, the most interesting, and he is certainly the one who gets the most attention in terms of later Jewish literature, is Elisha ben Avuya. First of all, for some reason, people like the dissonance. They like the people who are a little different, the people who make trouble. I mentioned last week there was a whole book written about him. Maybe. I mean, the reason I say maybe, because it's historical fiction. The only problem is that most people who read it don't realize it's fiction. They think they're reading history, but the historical fiction was written about Elisha ben Avuya. It was called As a Driven Leaf. It was written by a guy named Milton Steinberg. And he actually gives what I would call an overly sympathetic perspective of Elisha ben Avuya. It's overly sympathetic because he sees him as a very sympathetic type of character. There was one main passage that we read last time. I'll say the passage and then I'll just recap everything we saw last time. There was one passage last time that even though he lost his faith, there was at one point that he there was at one point that he tells his student that because it's Shabbat, he really can't travel any further, and he's gone as far as he is allowed to go. And that sounded like, even though he's an individual who has totally lost his faith, nonetheless, he's still very sympathetic and very nice and very tender and very good towards his, again, towards his former protege. So now let's go back and just think about what we saw last week. What we saw last week was an individual who goes up to heaven, has this religious experience. While he's there, something goes wrong. Again, exactly what it was that went wrong, it's harder for us to know. But this is what we're told, that he goes up and he sees an angel. And the angel is writing down all the deeds of the Jewish people. And Elisha ben Avuya uses this instead of saying, wow, it's true that every good deed we do is recorded and God rewards it and so on. Instead, we're told he has this religious crisis. And his religious crisis actually leads towards this issue of dualism, that there's an angel, but why is the angel sitting? And the angel sitting, maybe something is sapping its strength away. And it was this kind of theological questioning that I think most of us found really quite strange. Nonetheless, the angel gets punished for not standing up when it saw a human being comes. But then this angel who's writing down all the good deeds of Israel, he's given permission to erase that page, namely the deeds of Elisha ben Avuya. And at that moment, Elisha ben Avuya is in the middle of this revelation up in heaven and has just lost all of his good deeds. And he hears a voice. The voice says that God invites Shuvu banim shovavim, all of my mischievous children are invited to come back home, chutz mi Acher, except for Acher. Now, we don't know yet who Acher is and or why he's called Acher. And he then comes back down and he says, well, being that I lost my share in that world, I may as well enjoy this world. So we were told then he goes over to a prostitute and he asks her how much. And she says, aren't you Elisha ben Avuya? Like, aren't you this great rabbi? And then it says that he rips something out of the ground on Shabbat and hands it to her. And she says, Acher hu, he must be somebody else. The rest of the passage that we read was a series of discussions between Rabbi Meir and Elisha ben Avuya and his former teacher. And as I said, some of it was Elisha trying to trap him as well to lead him towards dualism. And some of it was Rav Meir trying to bring his teacher back. Finally, Rav Meir gets frustrated when Elisha keeps telling him, I just can't come back because I heard a voice telling me I can't. He drags him into one Beit Midrash after the other, and each one of them, and they ask a kid, what are you learning? And then the kid gives an answer, and each one of these kids says something to the effect that, you know, you can try to clean yourself, you try to use detergent, you can't get rid of the stain, you can't get rid of your sins, you can put on makeup, I can still see how ugly you are, and so on and so forth. All of them giving very difficult types of verses that they say, and Elisha sees this as a message that he really can't come back. But there was one more ominous thing that we ended with, that he walked into 13 different synagogues or a Beit Midrash, and by the 13th, the kid said something which he found insulting, and we're told then he takes out a knife and he kills this kid and cuts him into 13 pieces and sends him to all the other places. Now, at that point, I don't know how you can be so sympathetic to him or find that he's very tender and very nice and very caring. He just killed somebody, but there's this alternative ending, and that ending was, he said, if I had a knife on me, I would have killed him. And that's how we ended last time. Okay, so everything we did till now was based on the perspective of what's called the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. For us, it's the Gemara. Any of us who learned Gemara when we were in school, in high school, or maybe before even, the Gemara is generally the Talmud Bavli. But some of us know, hopefully, there's another Talmud. The other Talmud is called the Talmud Yerushalmi. It's somewhat of a misnomer, because it's really Talmud Eretz Yisrael. And it's not, don't misunderstand this, that the Bavli is only material from Bavel, and that the Yerushalmi is only material from Eretz Yisrael. It's not the case. Things travel back and forth. Information flows from one place to the other. The Bavli told us a story which I think is primarily theological, mystical, starts in heaven, debates theology, and ends up with one scene which is a little difficult. We were told initially, this is an important point, that Elisha ben Avuya was kotzetz b'netiot. He ripped up the things that were planted. Now that phrase, kotzetz b'netiot, till today in Kabbalistic, Hasidic, and some other works, would mean somebody who ripped up the foundations of Judaism. Somebody who questions or comes to conclusions against Jewish doctrine will be called kotzetz b'netiot, that they've ripped up the foundations. On its basic level, this phrase, kotzetz b'netiot, is a reflection of what I would call an extended metaphor. The metaphor is they went into Pardes. They went into Pardes, which literally means an orchard. Figuratively, it means paradise. The link between the two of them is the Garden of Eden. So therefore, you have some people that went into the Garden of Eden and had this experience. But if it's a paradise, it's the Garden of Eden, it's a garden. Kotzetz b'netiot therefore means somebody who ripped up the trees of the garden. Somebody who destroyed the Garden of Eden. Somebody who destroys heaven. Somebody who destroys paradise. And that's what Elisha ben Avuya is accused of. Now, if I ask, so how is that metaphor manifest in the Bavli? One, by going to heaven questioning monotheism. saying, I think there are two gods, Shtei Rishuyot. So that's Kotzitz Matiot. That's destroying one of the foundations. But if you needed a more tangible example of it, you have a beautiful triple application of it. What do I mean? The scene with the prostitute. A, again, he's doing something inappropriate with this woman. So that's one part, going against really, you know, not the way that one should behave. Secondly, what does he do? He rips out something out of the ground and hands it to her. Kotzeitz b'netiot. He rips something out of the ground. And on top of that, what was it that he did? He did it on Shabbat. So by desecrating Shabbat, he therefore is breaking one of the foundations of Judaism. So therefore you have sort of like this triple wrapped up Kotzeitz b'netiot metaphor being used, with a literal pulling something out of the ground, a figurative use it as well because he is breaking Shabbat, one of the foundations, and as I said, and giving this over to this prostitute, and therefore Kotzeitz b'netiot comes to mean all of these things together. So everything we've done till now was the Talmud Bavli. Now we're going to start all over again, and we're going to go to the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi is going to say, hold it, you know, who exactly is this? Same core teaching. Four people went into Paradis. One of them is Acher. What did Acher do? He was Kotzeitz b'netiot. What in the world does that mean? What happened? And that's where the Yerushalmi is going to start the story. But just to make this a little easier for you, the story the Yerushalmi is going to tell is going to be completely different. It's not going to include angels. It's not going to include going up into heaven. It's not going to include all these kinds of elements which we just now saw in the Bavli. But it's going to tell the same story. And that's also going to be a challenge for us because, you know, very often we are very literal. So if you hear words, description in one place, and then you hear different words describing something in a different place, you'll say, no, those are two different stories. But instead, what you have over here is the same story being told in two really radically different ways. So let's, enough introduction, let's start the Yerushalmi now. Let's look at the story that it tells us. And as I said, it's going to start really differently and then get a lot worse. So let's begin. So we're going to start today on page 7, on the bottom, source number 6. You got the English, the Hebrew. Acher hitzitz, he looked in Pardes, v'kitzetz b'netiot, and he ripped out the things that were planted. Money. Who's this? So Acher. Money. Acher. Who is Acher? I don't like the question mark where it is. I think the question mark really should be moved over there. I think that's the way it makes more sense. Money. Acher. Who is Acher? Elisha ben Avuya, Sheyahoreg Rabbe Torah. He was Elisha ben Avuya who killed teachers of Torah. So you have to stop right there. He was a murderer. Now, one of the first things you have to ask yourself, how in the world does somebody get away with murder? What do you mean he was a murderer? More than that, Amrin, was said, Kol tamid dahav chami le mishabach biaraita, havokatale. Any rabbi, young student, who was successful in learning, he would murder them. Now, suspend for a moment the questions, how you get away with this. The answer will become very obvious soon. V'lo, not only that. El dahavi alu lebet va'ada, he would go into the Beit Midrash, v'havachami talia kume safra, v'havyamar. He would see people sitting with books and learning, and he would say, Ma ilin yatvin avdin hacha, what in the world are you doing here? Umnate dahan banai. You should be a builder. Umnate dahan nagar. You should become a carpenter. Umnate dahan sayed. You should become a painter. Umnate dahan chayet. You should become a chayat is a tailor. The cave and the havushiman and cane. And then they would listen to him. Why would they listen to him? How do you get away with burning people? How do you empty out the Beit Midrash? Havin shrefkin leva azlon alavakat of omer. About him, the verse says, don't allow your mouth to cause your flesh to sin. For he really destroyed the deeds of this particular person, namely of himself, of Elisha ben Avuya. Now, we're not understanding this yet. But when we get to the next line, I just try to break them up into bite-sized pieces, it will become much more disturbing and much more understandable. Uf bishat. Uf bishat akta, during a terrible time, which means a time of ashmad, the time of religious persecution, havu mat'inan lund matilin. Okay, the Aramaic, I know you can't even guess, so let's just read the English here. During the time of shmad, religious persecution, it was decreed that Jews must carry publicly on Shabbat. Two people carried together, Acher said, make them carry by themselves. They carried by themselves, or each person put down in a carmelid. So let me pause and explain what I just now read. Elisha ben Avuya is the one who is a teacher of Torah. He is now teaching the Romans how to get Jews to break Shabbat properly. Now, the truth is, with that little line, we now unfortunately understand a lot more than we did before. Elisha ben Avuya joined the Romans. He became a Roman advisor. Not only became a Roman advisor, he became a Roman advisor to teach them how to make the Jews abandon religion. So, most likely, and again, now I may be going a little bit too far, but I apologize, but I may not be. I think he's the one who tells the Romans, if you want to break the Jewish spirit, make them all break Shabbat. So they say they must all publicly break Shabbat. He goes, how do you break Shabbat? You have to carry something outside. Now, here is a little technicality that maybe some of us know, maybe some of us don't know. If two people carry something together, technically it's not really breaking Shabbat on a Torah level. On a rabbinic level, but not a Torah level. To break Shabbat on a Torah level, a person needs to do something which they can do by themselves. If two people together do something that one could have done, then it's like each one of them broke Shabbat halfway, but halfway is not what's prohibited on a Torah level. It's a whole action by yourself. So if somebody did something by themselves, then if somebody did something by themselves, they'd be guilty. So the Romans said, the Jews, you must break Shabbat. So they would see two Jews carrying something together. And the Romans were all proud of themselves. Look, we're making them break Shabbat. Elisha Mavui says, what are you doing? If two people carrying it together, they're not breaking Shabbat. Make them carry things by themselves, which means he uses his Torah knowledge in order to teach the Romans how to force Jews to break Shabbat and break their spirit. The second point of what he does then is there's something which is called a carmelit. Okay, a little bit of laws of Shabbat. I apologize, but it's the only way to understand this passage. On Shabbat, there are two different rishuyot, or places, locations. What's called the Rishut HaYachid and Rishut HaRabim, a private and a public domain. There's also two others. One is called a Makom Ptur, and the other is called a Carmelit. Now, a Carmelit, and I'll tell you the truth, the average yeshiva student cannot tell you what a Carmelit is. The Roman soldiers did not know what a Carmelit is. So a Carmelit is something which is halfway between a public and a private place. I don't know if you ever noticed, let's say in Israel, these big garbage they're the size of a car, which sit outside on the street. That would be a perfect carmelit. It's not a public area, but it's not a private area. It's not a house, but it's also not something which is public. It's something in between. So on a Torah level, if you carried something in a public area and put it down in the carmelit, you didn't break Shabbat. So what did the Jews do? The Romans said you have to break Shabbat. So first they said two people do it together. Elisha ben Avuya says, no, make them do it by themselves. So what do? They would carry something and put it down by a carmelit. And the Romans said, they're breaking Shabbat now because they're carrying it in public. And then Elisha ben Avuya teaches them the law of a carmelit and says, no, that's not a good enough way of breaking Shabbat. You need to make them break Shabbat absolutely and don't let them put it down on a carmelit. So I just need to point out now. Last week when we read this beautiful story about Elisha ben Avuya and Rabbi Meir was riding on his horse, Rabbi Meir was walking and he was very tender. Oh, you're going too far. Don't break Shabbat. Over here, he's forcing people to break Shabbat. Over here, he's involved in murder. And by the way, killing young yeshiva students may be what they mean by kotzetz benetiot. He ripped out the young things that were growing. He killed the young yeshiva students, or he forced them out of the Beit Midrash. That may be the Yerushalmi's understanding of kotzetz benetiot. Which means, again, the Yerushalmi is much more historical, much more literal, and much less mystical, although I think it's equally theological. So, where the Bavli hinted at the very end, the Yerushalmi just starts off, full, on discussion. Here is a man who was the mastermind of the destruction of Judaism, had blood on his hands for killing people, which means I think it's far more disturbing, and it's very hard now to describe him in sympathetic terms. Oh, he was really a nice guy. He just had a little crisis of faith. No, here's a man whose crisis of faith, for some reason, it wasn't the live and let live. You know, like maybe we could have understood from the story with Rev Meir, it wasn't the live and let live. It was rather a live and let die. Sorry for, you know, at least who wrote that? Live and let die. Okay, now you have your homework. So it was something which was far more disturbing than we had thought before. Let's continue and let's take a look at as the source continues to the next part. Once upon a time, Rav Meir is giving a drasha in the Beit Midrash. Rav Meir was sitting, expanded the Beit Midrash in Tveria on Shabbat, and Elisha rode by on his horse. So again, one of the things I mentioned last time is the horse is a symbol of Roman power. Jews are never on horses in Talmudic times. Romans are on horses. So now you realize how perfect that is. Of course he's on a horse. He has become a Roman. And he's riding by on his horse, and the people then say to him, your rabbi's outside, which I think was very insulting to him. Your rabbi, this Roman dignitary now. He stopped the drasha and went out to him. Elisha said, what did he teach today? And he says that God blessed more at the end. Now, I want to stop here and explain to what we're talking about. This text is talking about Eov. That was one of the things I got a little into last week. Eov, Job, is a book about why bad things happen to good people. Eov is a book about, at the very beginning of the book, is a man who's a nice man, a decent man, an honest man, a good man, who then loses everything. He loses his kids, he loses his house, he loses his wealth, he loses everything. At the end of the book, everything comes back again. So now, when Elisha ben Avuya asked him, so what were you teaching about? He says, oh, he's thinking about Job. What do you teach about Job? He said, well, I was teaching the end of the book, the judge things on their end, which, by the way, is really a response to this question of why bad things happen to good people. Bad things, he's claiming, are when you look at things in the middle. Don't judge things in the middle of a process. Sometimes you need to look at something based upon the end of the process, not the middle of the process, the end of the process. You can have a bad day. That doesn't mean you have a bad life, right? Something difficult happened today. That doesn't mean tomorrow's going to be bad. And therefore, the best proof is Eov, Job, lost all the things. But at the end of the book, which, by the way, according to the rabbis, really is a metaphor, at the end of the book, it says that he gets twice as much wealth. Everything works out at the end. And he says, focus on the end. That was my talk. Focus on the end. Don't focus on the middle. Which, by the way, may also be an attack against the Romans. Don't get all upset that the Romans right now are powerful. It's at the end who wins. It's not who is in charge right now. And this thought that he's sharing, at least the way that I'm understanding it, is a direct response to what's going on in the Romans and is a direct response to the belief that now Elisha ben Avuya has. So he says, what were you teaching today? So he said, I was teaching that God blessed him in the end. He goes, okay, what else did he say? What else did he say in the talk? He said, God blessed Eov in the end of his life, more in the beginning. He gave him twice as much wealth. Elisha then says, you know, woe unto what's lost and can't be found. He says, your teacher Akiva didn't say it like this, but rather he said, Eov was blessed more in the beginning because of all the good deeds that he did in the beginning. Which means essentially what he's saying is that the beginning will dictate what the end is. You need a good foundation. He asks him, what else did you teach? And he said, I taught that, again, the most important thing is the end. He goes, for example, you have a person who has children and loses their children and then has more children. I want to pause there for a second. I'm going to continue, but I'm going to explain this point. He goes, you have a person who has money and loses his money and then makes more money. So then focus on the end, don't focus on the middle. Now, there is a little bit of emotional blackmail in all of this. Rabbi Meir himself, we know from another passage, had two kids who died. I don't know if you ever heard the story. He was married to this woman named Bruria, and Bruria told him one day that the following, she said, the two kids died on a Shabbat. He comes home, where are the kids? She goes, no, just sit down, I want to talk to you first. And she says, you know, a while ago somebody lent me something and then wanted it back. And do I have to give it back? He goes, of course you have to give it back. And she goes, what if I feel bad? He goes, you can't feel bad. Somebody asked for it back. So then she takes him to the other room and she says, the one who lent this to us wanted it back, showing her kids. Rav Meir lost two kids. And now he says, if a person lost kids and then had new kids, should they spend the rest of their life mourning the kids that they lost? Or should they spend their time loving the kids that they have. If you had a lot of money, lost your money, and made new money, should you obsess on the money you lost or be happy with what you have right now? Now, I'm not saying that there aren't nightmares. I'm not saying there aren't scars. I'm not saying that life isn't difficult sometimes. But what I am saying is that it's very interesting what he's pointing out over here is that things could be difficult right now in the middle, and don't you draw your conclusions based upon what's going on right now. And I'll say it again. Rav Meir is very much going after Elisha ben Avuya in terms of his rejection of Judaism because of the current state of affairs. And Rav Meir is saying, let's see how the game ends. You know, let's just take the same argument in a different way. If you would look at the debates between Jews and Christians for the most part over the last 1,500 years, you'll find that it was always one that the Christians argued that, but we're more powerful, so God rejected you. And what if the Jewish response would have been, well, that's the middle of the game right now. Let's wait to the end. Let's see how things work out. And it's very hard to have that argument or that faith all those years back. But essentially, that's what Meir is saying. We have faith, and just because the Romans are in charge right now doesn't mean anything for the end. And that's really between the lines of all this. But then he gets a little bit more personal in what he says in the next paragraph. He says, or for example, so far he said money and kids, or for example, Adam shelamad Torah benaruto ushachacha, or it's like a person who learned Torah and forgot their Torah, uvizikno v'kaima, but then they were older, they learned Torah again, So if you became a scholar again at the end of your life, that's what's important. And then again he says that that's not the way that Rabbi Akiva taught it. It's only things are good at the end if they were good at the beginning. And now Elisha ben Avuya is about to make an excuse. He's going to tell us now why his life is the way that it is, and how he got here. So let's pay attention now. Ubi haya hama'aseh. And he goes, and this is what happened to me. So he goes on to tell that his father, Avuya, Elisha ben Avuya, Avuya was one of the great men of Jerusalem. On the day of his Brit Milah, he invited all the great people there, and two people come in, and this is the one part of the Yerushalmi which is mystical. And Rabbi Eliezer and Yeshua sat in another room, and all the people started to eat and to drink and to dance and to clap and so on. And Rabbi Eliezer said to Rabbi Yeshua, no, let them do what they do, we'll do what we do. And they began to study, and they connected the Torah to the Navi, and the Navi to the Ketuvim. And now this is not a metaphor, it means this literally. And there was so much joy, it became as if it were at Har Sinai. And at Har Sinai, a fire surrounded the mountain. And in over here, a fire came into the room, and his father walked in, and his father said, are you trying to burn down my house? What in the world's going on? And then they said, no, this is the fire of Sinai. And my father then said, if this is the power of Torah, if my child survives, I want to dedicate him to study Torah. So over here, Elisha ben Avuya just now made an excuse as to why his life is the way that it is, because his foundation is faulty. That his involvement in Torah was based upon an attraction to power. Now, if we were to go a little bit further, and again, psychoanalyze a little bit, it's very clear to me the day that he gives up on Torah, the day the Romans destroy the Beit HaMikdash and show that they are the ones with the power. At that point, why stay with Torah? Move on to the thing with the most power. Which means he's saying my involvement wasn't because on a foundational level I believed in good, I believed in truth, I believed in what's right. Essentially, I was taught to get involved in Torah because of the power involved in it. So the way that he's telling the story is, my foundation is faulty, so how can you expect me to ever come back to it? Because you can only come back to something where the foundation is strong, and I have a weak foundation. By the way, I hope you understand some of the irony in this. Just for example, Rabbi Akiva, who we recognize as being a Baal Tshuva, so how strong is Rabbi Akiva's foundation? How does Rabbi Akiva, with a lack of a foundation at all, become one of the greatest rabbis? By the way, Rabbi Meir himself was a convert. So therefore, Rabbi Meir's foundation is probably not all that great either. So here, Elisha ben Avuya, who's raised in the greatest, one of the really prominent Jewish families, he's saying, oh, my foundation wasn't that good. So you just have to ask yourself, is he saying something which is really fundamentally true, or is he essentially just making an excuse as to why he believes that he can't possibly succeed? It's in this context that something else happens. So as all this is taking place, he then says, okay, what else did you teach? And this is source 11. And he said, I was teaching about gold and glass that if they get broken, they can always be fixed. So too, a Tamid Chacham, either a student or a rabbi, Sheshachach Talmudo, who forgets his learning, can come back and relearn. Then he says, Dayach Meir Ad Kan Tchum Shabbat. Meir, you've gone far enough. This is the Tchum of Shabbat. So I'm going to stop the story in the middle before I continue it, because in the Bavli, that was the one point which was, I'm going to say it again, was tender and sympathetic. No, you've gone as far as you go. In the Yerushalmi, his response, you've gone too far, is only when he says, why don't you fix your Torah, because everything can be fixed. Then he says, you've gone too far. Meaning it's not, let me put it this way. The Elisha ben Nevuya we meet in the Yerushalmi is somebody who actually tries to get Jews to break Shabbat. In the Bavli, he himself broke Shabbat, which means he tries, he rips people out of the Beit Midrash. He forces people publicly to break Shabbat. And now he tells Rav Meir, you can't go any further, which means it's like Rav Meir got a little too close. Yes, the whole relationship is bizarre. How in the world you keep in touch with your rabbi who's now become an executioner and part of the Roman death machine and war against Judaism, Rav Meir nonetheless does. How in the world Elisha ben Avuya still allows this teacher or Rabbi Meir to talk to him like this? That's also interesting. But now, instead of this being this tender comment, it's rather in the Yerushalmi you realize you've gone as far as you can go is a response, don't push me any further. That's it. Now, we still don't know why in the Yerushalmi, because we haven't been told any reason, why it is he can't go further, but now he's going to offer it. Amrle, min hein at yada, how do you know this is as far as you can go on Shabbat? Amrle, min tafli desusi davina mani. He goes, I've been counting the footsteps of the horse. V'holei chalpayim ama. Amrle, and it's already went 2,000 amot, which is as far as you can go on Shabbat. Amrle, v'kol hacha chachmate itpe. He goes, you have so much wisdom, v'leit at chazar bach, and you're not going to come back and do tshuva. Amrle, leit ana yachil. I can't. Now, this is the first time we heard this in the Yerushalmi. I can't do tshuva. Amrle, lama? Why? Amrle, he responds, Shepamachad, once upon a time, Hayiti over lefnei Beit Kodesh HaKadoshim, once I passed by the destroyed temple, the place that the Holy of Holies once was, Rachuv al Susi biyom kippurim shechal b'Shabbat, I rode over on Yom Kippur, which happened to be on a Shabbat. So he's desecrating Shabbat. He's desecrating Yom Kippur. He's desecrating the Beit HaMikdash. V'shamati bat kol yotza mibet kodesh HaKadoshim. And I heard a voice, so this is fascinating. Again, in the Bavli, this takes place up in heaven. He hears things in heaven. In the Yerushalmi, he hears it by the holiest place on earth, the place that the Holy Holies once was, the place where the Kohen Gadol entered on Yom Kippur, the Omeret. And what was the voice I heard? Shuvu banim. Everybody come back. Chutz me Elisha ben Avuya, except for Elisha ben Avuya, sheyada kochi umaradbi. Because he knew my power, and nonetheless, he rebelled against me. So this combination of scenes, Elisha ben Avuya tells us his foundation is off. Nonetheless, there's something about him which is drawn to this place on Yom Kippur, and he hears this murmuring. And, again, anybody else would say, wow, Judaism is true. The voice of God calls out from the holiest place on Yom Kippur, telling us to come home. But the voice over here says, everybody come back, but Elisha, don't. Everybody's invited, but Elisha, you're not invited. He then gives us a little bit more information, and we'll read this, I think, two more things, and then we're going to try to deal with the theology involved in all of this. One scene is he tells us again where his crisis takes place. And again, this goes simply to the point of tzaddik v'ralo, theodicy, why bad things happen to good people. The kol da min hein at atatle, and why did all this happen to him? Ela pamachad, once upon a time, yoshev v'shonim b'vikat ginasar, he was once sitting and learning in a place called Ginosar, by the way. Ginosar is a pardes. Ginosar is a place with incredible fruit and incredible trees, which I find a little bit more than just ironic. I think that there's some substance to this. V'ra adam achad ala l'rosh hadekel, and you see somebody climb up a tree. V'notal eim al banim v'yirad misham v'shalom. and somebody climb up and take the eggs, even though the mother bird was there, and everything was fine. Lamachar, the next day he sees, Ra Adam Acher, Sha'ala L'Rosh HaDekel, somebody climb up the Dekel, V'Natal Eim Etabanim V'Shilach Eta'im. He takes the eggs, but he shooed away, he sent the mother away, the way the Torah tells us to do it. V'Yarad Misham V'Kishu Nachash V'Met. He comes down, and a snake bites him and dies. By the way, in terms of symbolism, there's lots and lots of Garden of Eden symbolism to all this. One, it's in Ginosar, which is like a paradise. Two, you have these trees. Another thing, you have a serpent, and the serpent bites you and dies. And the reason there's death in the world is because of the serpent, because we sinned in the Garden of Eden. And he's saying, hold it, on a micro level, why is this one person dying when he obeyed the words of the Torah? He says, Amar Ketiv, it says, Shalach tishlach ata'im v'tabanim tikach lach l'man yitev lach l'arach t'yamim. The Torah says, send away the mother bird in order to have a good life and have a long life. Where's his good life? Where's his long life? And he didn't know that there was already a teaching of Rav Yaakov saying that God rewards sometimes in this world and sometimes in another world. It's the world to come, nothing to do with this world. Others say, V'yesh Omer Shira L'shono Shav Yehuda Nachtom. He sees one of the ten martyrs, this Rabbi Yehuda, who they ripped his tongue out, and they gave it to a dog to eat. Natun b'pi kelev shotet dam. Amar zu Torah v'zu schora. This is Torah, and this is its reward. Zeh L'shon she'amotzi divrei Torah kitiknan. This is the tongue that taught Torah properly. Zeh L'shon she'yogeya b'Torah kol yamav. This is the one who taught Torah his whole life. Zu Torah v'zu schora. This is Torah, and this is its reward. Dome, it seems to me, she'ein matan schar ve'ein tchiyat ha'metim. There's no reward, there's no resurrection, there's no anything. And he rejects everything. And then there's one more half a phrase here, saying, and some say when his mother was pregnant, she went by a place of idolatry, sort of like the story with Esav, and she smelled the smell of the offerings, and that somehow impacted him. One last scene, despite everything we read, La'ach yamim chalash Elisha. Why went by and he got sick? Atum Rabin Rav Meir, hey Rab Chaboyish. And they came to Rav Meir and said, your teacher is dying. He came to visit him, and he finds that he's dying. Amrle doesn't give up, Rav Meir, never gives up. Late at Chazarbach, aren't you going to do tshuva? Amrle, v'in chazirin metkablim, and if I do tshuva, I'll be accepted. Amrle, v'lo kenktiv, doesn't it say that in Tehillim? Teshev enosh ad daka, a person to the very last breath, should return ad dichducha shel nefesh mekablim, that God will accept somebody even if it's their very last breath. And in his very last breath, he cried and he died. Rav Meir samach b'libo va'omer. Rav Meir was rejoiced in his heart, and he said, "Dome shemitoch tshuva niftar rabbi." And he says, "It seems to me that my rabbi died doing tshuva." So let's pause again. The story that we have in the Bavli. Okay, hopefully we understood that. The story that we have over here in the Yerushalmi is very disturbing on many levels. It's a story of rejection of Jewish values. He makes excuses along the way. He joins the Romans. He advises the Romans. He has blood on his hands. And still, Rav Meir never gives up on him. And still, Rav Meir insists on trying to bring him back to the very, very end. He makes excuses. He says, my foundation is weak. I can't fix it. He says, Elisha says, that my father had me learn Torah for the wrong reasons. He says, I witnessed, you know, bad things happen to good people. And now you realize that's why Rav Meir kept coming back to these points. Bad things happen, good things happening. You can't judge things in the middle of the story. And yeah, we live in a world where there's death ever since the Garden of Eden. We have death in the world and we have serpents who try to attack us and so on and so forth. So the theological question that I want to address or try to deal with in the time that we have left is, could this person have done tshuva? Now, those of you who are in my other class, we did discuss Paro a bit and the hardening of his heart. We discussed the idea that God punished Paro at some point and says, that's it. It's not some right that you have at every point in your life that you can fix anything that you've ever done, God can say, listen, I decided, I'm pulling the plug on you. You no longer have free will, and I'm taking away your ability to fix things. So we did see the Rambam say that, even though when we learned about this, I preferred the approach of the Sforno, where we learned that it wasn't that God took away Paro's free will. It's actually that God gave him his free will, because Paro then was able to do what he wanted to do. What did Paro want to do? He wanted to hold on to the Jews as slaves. What was stopping him from that? The fact that God gave him plague after plague after plague. The plagues took away the free will. The hardening of the heart returned the free will. So that was what we had learned back then. Going back to Elisha ben Avuya, so this is a really popular theme. Lots and lots of books, lots and lots of people deal with this. And the basic question is, could he have done tshuva or not? So let's try to, let's try to look at different things. The first thing that I want to mention is that it never said, actually, those words that you cannot do tshuva. Never really said that. There is a passage in the Zohar, which I think should be understood that way, as saying, that's it. He's gone too far. He can't do tshuva. I'll just point it out. The Zohar is in source number, give me a second, source 24. And I'm not going to explain the whole thing, but essentially it says that somebody who ends up embracing non-existence ends up having non-existence. And it says you shouldn't serve other gods, Elohim Acherim, and Elisha serves other gods and therefore becomes Acher. And that's why his soul now is bound up with this other that doesn't exist and therefore inherits non-existence. That's essentially what the Zohar says in this source over here, source 24. The Shla HaKadosh, source 25. Now, the Shla is a mystical book. He's one of the conduits whereby the teachings of the Arizal make it into Europe. He here grapples with this a bit. He grapples with a whole, this is in Rosh Hashanah, dealing with tshuva, and he grapples with a whole bunch of people who perhaps should not have been able to do tshuva. And along the way, we're definitely not going to read the whole piece, he comes back and he says, Va'od afilu Elisha Acher, even Acher, im hivtzir v'hiba b'tfila, if he would have really prayed, and he would have really done unbelievable things, he goes, I think then it really he would have been accepted. And he goes on to say, even though he heard a voice saying, that Acher can't come back, he should not have stopped himself from doing tshuva, and he then goes into some other people who speak in the same way. So one is sort one that we just now saw, and I'm going to explain things a little bit more as we move on, is Lashon saying, I think he could have done tshuva. The second is a teaching mentioned by the Tiferet Shlomo. This is a Hasidic writer, Shlomo from Radomsk, who's going to quote the Maggid of Mezrich over here. He says, B'shem Adoni Mori V'Rebi Ish Eloki Moreno Rav Dov Ber Mi Mezrich. That's known as the Maggid of Mezrich. And he says, he tells a story of somebody, the Maggid, who one time prayed for somebody who was sick with such devotion, and for a lack of a better word, I'm going to say, he prayed with such chutzpah. God, you better heal this guy, you know, this person, you know, now you have to heal this person, and so on. He prayed with such chutzpah that he got a message from heaven that he went too far, and that's it, he lost his share in the world to come. And then he says to himself, that's great, because now I can go even further, and I can have even more chutzpah and pray even more, which is a very funny thought. But then he takes this, Shlomo from Medamsk, and connects it with Acher. And he's the same thing with Elisha ben Avuya. Once he was told that he went, you know, that he can't be taken back, he goes, that's wonderful. Now you can pray for real. And he goes, and then he says something which I think is theologically really significant. He says, that's the advantage of a Baal Tshuva. I mean, we're told sometimes that a place that a Baal Tshuva exists, you know, a real tzaddik couldn't go. He goes, what's the difference in a real tzaddik and a Baal Tshuva? A real tzaddik knows, I did something good today, I did something good yesterday, I did something good the day before, and I'm going to pray to God, and God is going to like me because I keep doing good things. He goes, a Baal Tshuva who's done embarrassing things, I've done bad day after day after day, and now I say that I'm sorry, the Baal Tshuva is going to have a lot more hesitation and is not going to believe in themselves and is going to therefore have to try so much harder. And he says, okay, but because the Baal Tshuva has a lack of confidence, their prayers and their tshuva is going to be so much more profound. And he says, Elisha ben Avuya, the same thing. That you've gone so far, so now you have to work a lot harder, and that's okay. So far, again, we saw the Zohar say, no, you're like stuck on the other side, as it were. But then we saw the Shla saying, no, it's okay. You just have to work a lot harder. And again, the Maggid of Mezr saying something similar. I actually heard something very similar from in the name of the Vilna Gaon. It's a little different, but I think we can apply it as well. The Vilna Gaon once was stuck in Vilna, which, by the way, is quite predictable, without the Arba Minim before the holiday of Sukkot, without a lulav and an etrog and adasim and aravot. And if you think about it, just about none of those things actually grow. You don't have palm trees growing off in Vilna. You don't have citrus growing there. You don't have hadasim growing there. To get the various minim was really difficult. They had to import them from very far away. So he sent a student and he asked him, please, try to find. And he couldn't find. And as he's traveling in one city, he stops and there's one guy who has the Arba Minim and he says, I want to buy it from you. He goes, it's not for sale. He goes, no, this is for the Vilna Gaon. He goes, I don't care who it's for. I'm not selling it. And he keeps on talking. He goes, don't you know he's one of the greatest rabbis? So then finally he says, fine, I'll sell it to you, but on one condition. He goes, what's that? He goes, the condition is that whatever schar, whatever merit he gets for doing this mitzvah, I want the mitzvah. He goes, I can't sell you his schar. He goes, that's the only way. Finally, when he realizes that he has no choice, he agrees, he makes this deal. Comes back to the Vilna Gaon, says, I got good news and bad news. The good news is I found the Arba Minim. The bad news is I sold your merit, I sold your schar, I sold the mitzvah. So he said that the Vilna Gaon's response was that he was overjoyed. He said that whenever I would serve God till now, at least on some level, was also to get reward. Now I'm doing it simply because God wants me to do it, and it's the right thing to do. That's it. No reward. I can finally serve God in a pure way. So when I think about Elisha ben Avuya, and I think if I were a bimeir, and I was talking to him, and he says, I can't do tshuva. I say, what difference? It's not your problem if you can do tshuva or not. Which means if you believe that killing people is the wrong thing, if you believe that keeping Shabbat is the right thing, so do the right thing because it's the right thing. Don't do the right thing because God's going to give you reward, not going to give you reward. Which means ultimately, what does the reward have to do with doing the right thing? Is murdering people wrong? So don't murder people. Is keeping Shabbat right? Then keep Shabbat. Which means what is this excuse? Oh, because God said you can't do tshuva. Which means essentially, let's think of it this way. What if you get into a huge fight with your mother and she kicks you out of the house and you know you're wrong? She says, I never want to talk to you again. Do you call her up anyway and say, listen, I'm wrong and I want to apologize? Or you say, that's it. She never wants to see me again, so that's it. I mean, think about it like this. Elisha ben Avuya essentially has the choice. Do I follow what God tells me to do? Or do I ignore what God tells me to do? So just again, think about that for a second. What is it that God told him to do? Well, God said to him, keep Shabbat. God said to him, keep kosher. God said to him, don't go to prostitutes. And God said, oh yeah, by the way, don't bother trying to come back because I'm not going to accept it. Can you explain to me why he thinks that the one thing he should listen that God said to him is that it's not going to work if you do tshuva, and all the other things that God says, oh no, that I can't do because God didn't listen to me. Which what I'm trying to get to is that his perception of this bat kol that he heard, I think is really self-serving. It's very self-serving in the sense, oh, God said I can't do tshuva. So what that God said you can't do tshuva? So on the one hand, this is a perfect opportunity to do it anyway. And I think that there's a deeper point to all of this. God said you're not invited. Think about the words. Shuvu banim shovim. Everybody's invited to come back and do tshuva. Chutz me'acher, acher is not invited. Does that mean you can't do tshuva? Or does that mean you're not invited to do tshuva? What if the most important event was taking place, but you're not invited? So what do? You crash. You can't get through the front door, you go through the back door. You can't get in as a guest, you try to get a job as one of the people working there. If you have to get in, you're going to get in one way or the other. The fact that God doesn't invite you to come through the front door doesn't mean that you can't go there. So essentially what I'm pointing out is that Elisha ben Avuya really should have tried to find another way to get in. And it never said that I'm not going to accept your tshuva. It says you're not invited. See, I think that there's a point over here which is connected to a teaching that the Rambam has. Before I read the Rambam, let me... Have you all heard there's a teaching that if you say, I'm going to sin deliberately, but then I'll do tshuva, that God says, no, that's not a real thing. You can't do that. Which means we all mess up. And you could mess up. And after you mess up, then you could try to fix it. But can you deliberately put on your calendar, September 10th, sin in big red letters. But then September 15th, tshuva, like in nice blue letters. You can't do that. You can't be cynical like that. Now, does it work? So the Mishnah implies it doesn't work. But the Rambam explains the Mishnah with a nuance, which I think is really important. So listen to the teaching of the Rambam. It says, verse 28, Ha'omer echte v'ashuv, echte v'ashuv. A person says, I'm going to sin and do tshuva, I'm going to sin and do tshuva. Or Ha'omer echte v'yom kippur mechaper. Or a person says, I'll sin, but then Yom Kippur is going to fix it. Ein yom kippur mechaper. Kamo amran, ein maspikim b'yadol lasot tshuva. Ulefichach, therefore, lo ya'azruhu Hashem. Do you see those two words, ya'azruhu Hashem? You know, sometimes you say, be'ezrat Hashem. With God's help, lo ya'azru Hashem sheyaseh b'tzom kippur mashiru'i lo la'asot kedei shetchapru lo avodotav b'oto yom. That you're going to end up, God is not going to help you. Now that, I think, is a phenomenal point. Can you imagine somebody who, I'll give you a male-oriented, but you can flip it around as a female-oriented. There's somebody who says that I'm going to go to Yom Kippur, and I'm going to do tshuva, I'm going to pray. And then he notices right next to him, on the other side of the mechitza, this girl that he is dying to meet. And during the whole time of Yom Kippur, instead of looking in his sidur, he keeps looking at the girl instead. By the way, you can say it the other way around. Girl comes, and then she sees this guy that she's been interested, and the whole time he's standing right there in front. And instead of focusing on the tefillah, he's just standing over there. Which means this idea of saita dishmaya, Azrat Hashem, that God helps us do what we do, that it doesn't mean you can't do it if God doesn't help you, but it means it's much more difficult. So therefore, Yom Kippur is a time that generally God helps us. You walk into the shul, and you have the tunes, and you have the tefillah, and you have the mood, and you have, you know, the atmosphere, and you have the other people, and so on. It's generally that Yom Kippur, there is Ezrat Hashem. So what's he saying? If you're cynical and says, I'm going to sin and then Yom Kippur is going to help me, it says God is saying, I'm not going to help you. Now, there's a very big difference between saying, I am not going to help you versus saying that you can't do tshuva. It just made it a lot harder. And God says, everybody's invited. You're not invited. That doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that you're not invited. And if you're not invited, you're going to have to work much, much harder in order to make it happen. So I think that there's a lot of truth in that approach and using this Rambam to explain, okay, God's not going to help. Now it's up to you. I actually want to try to say a little bit deeper, but before I do, there is a wonderful teaching of Rabbi Soloveitchik, which I'm not going to read to you, but it's here on the page for you. It starts here. It's source number 33. It goes on for 3-4 pages at least. Yes. It's worthwhile reading. It is really, especially if any of you always thought, you know, I just can't read Rabbi Soloveitchik because it's too hard, it's too complicated, whatever. It is a brilliant analysis of our topic. And I'll ruin it for you. I'll tell you what he's going to say. He's going to say that there's a kind of a spiritual schizophrenia or a spiritual bipolar, which takes place within this individual, that there are two people. There's Elisha ben Avuya, the rabbi, and then there's Acher, the sinner. And the problem is that Elisha ben Avuya thinks that he's Acher. And I'm going to say again, all of us at times mess up, and all of us at times do good. Now the question is, who are we for real? Are we for real that person who messes up, or are we for real that person who wants to do the right thing? Are we essentially good people who make mistakes who need to fix them, or are we essentially really bad people, and even when we try to fix them, we're just not being authentic? That's really the question. Who is the authentic us? Who is the authentic me? Who is the individual? So he claims that the authentic person was Elisha ben Avuya, but he became confused and he thought the authentic individual was Acher, and he thought that he was this bad, terrible individual, and he could not get away of that self-identification. And therefore God says, Shuvah banim, shuvah, everybody comes back but except for Acher. Acher can't be fixed, but he was really trying to say, Elisha ben Avuya, get rid of Acher. He's not you. You can come back, but Acher can't come back. And as I said, it's really interesting to read his approach, but that's essentially what he says. But I want to go back and get to what I think is really the issue over here. And what I'm about to say, you know, as much as the various approaches that I already gave you or presented, it could be that you could read little pieces of what I'm going to say and some of the others, but I think in the emphasis that I'm going to say is a little bit different. What exactly is the core sin? When I say core sin, that's a very important concept. There are manifestations of sin, and then there's a core behavior issue, which means a manifestation of sin could lead me to do X, Y, and Z, but the core is what is the foundational problem. Now, he told us the foundation is that his foundation wasn't good. Why? Because his father said, learn Torah because of pragmatism. Learn Torah because of the power, which is essentially a setup. It's a setup for failure. The moment that he finds that there's something else which is more powerful, what's more powerful? The Romans are more powerful, which means the moment that the Romans destroy the Beit HaMikdash, his faith goes together with it. Why? Because his involvement in Torah has always been simply because of the power. Now, when he's discovered something else which is powerful, he says, okay, I don't need this. I'm going to go to something else which is powerful. So therefore, he hears a voice saying, you can't do tshuva. What was the core of his sin? The core of his sin is pragmatism. Which means if he, for the first time in his life, would have done tshuva thinking that it won't work, not because he's going to get tzchar, not because he's going to be rewarded, but he's going to do for the first time the right thing because it's the right thing, that would have fixed the foundational problem within his ideology. Which means the idea that you ought, meaning if you would tell me I do tshuva to be fixed, that's again going right back to this point of pragmatism. And that's exactly what his problem is, which means in order to try to heal him, in order of trying to fix him, what he's going to need to do is to do the right thing because it's the right thing. And therefore, God says, no, don't do tshuva. It's not going to, right? You're not invited. So now he has to ask himself, okay, will I do it or not? So what it comes down to, most of the theologians who deal with this teaching, I'm going to say again, the Zohar, anybody who follows that Zohar is going to be the exception, but most of the authorities go in the direction that I presented. There are those who even say, who said he heard such a bat call? I think the Lubavitcher Rebbe said that. He made it up. Never said it. God never said that to him. He totally made it up. The weakness with that is that when he went to the 13 Batei Midrash afterwards, and all the kids repeated pretty much the same direction as the bat kol, so I have a harder time saying that he just made it up. I don't think that that's a very easy position to take. But did he misunderstand the bat kol? I think that's a much stronger position. So again, Rabbi Salvechik says he misunderstood the bat kol. The bat kol was talking to Acher and not talking to Elisha ben Avuya. I don't think that you have to go that far either. I think you can say that the bat kol says you're not invited. That's it. You're not invited. Being not invited doesn't mean you can't crash, which means you want to do tshuva, you figure out a way to do tshuva. For some people, God is going to make it much easier. For some of us, God is going to invite us. For some of us, God is going to say, come on during Elul, and come during Rosh Hashanah, and come during Yom Kippur, and fix what you need to fix. And again, it's this bat kol, as it were, calling us out and telling us to come. And he hears that bat kol, inviting everybody else on Yom Kippur. The fact that he didn't hear it, or the fact that he felt he wasn't invited. But again, let's consider something. How many other people killed Jews? How many other people were involved in advising the Romans how to cause the Jews not to keep Shabbat? How many other people were riding on a horse on Yom Kippur and Shabbat on the place, desecrating the place that the Beit HaMikdash once stood? Which, by the way, I think really gets to his anger issues. His anger is that the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. And that's why he's, in a sense, supporting his decision of going on the other side. Because look at the Beit HaMikdash destroyed. But therefore, he who is not in Beit Knesset, he who's desecrating a place which is holy, God says you're not invited. But just because you're not invited doesn't mean that you can't crash. So I think that ultimately this approach of saying that anybody can do tshuva, but sometimes it's harder. I think that's important as well. Sometimes we do things that makes it harder, but making it harder doesn't make it impossible to do.